40 years ago, 200 members of the American Indian Movement took over the town of Wounded Knee, South Dakota. The group was protesting the federal government's failure to honor the various treaties with the Native tribes. The location was symbolic. In 1890, as many as 300 Lakota Indians were killed at Wounded Knee by the U.S. Army. The 1973 standoff lasted 173 days and claimed three lives. A new book from Michigan State University Press recounts that incident and other moments in the history of the American relationship with its indigenous people. Wynonna LaDuke is the author of The Militarization of Indian Country. She's a member of the Anishinaabe, thank you, Anishinaabe Nation, and she spoke with current state's Kevin Lavery.
Actually, the American military power has a lot of dominance on a world scale. So we're not unique in this situation, considering it's the largest military in the world, dwarfing everybody by about seven times. But the reality is that, you know, historically, Native people, American Indian people, were classified in the Department of War. We moved to Department of Interior in the last century. But just prior to that, we were over there in Department of War. And having said that, we ended up in a situation where there's a lot of military bases near Indian reservations, largely to, you know, from the Indian Wars. And over time, some of those bases disappeared and just became cities and towns, but a number of them continued and became full-scale military installations. And so to the extent that the United States military is a large landowner with a huge impact on the ecology and social and economics of a region, there is a significant impact on the Native community.
Our military is laden with references to Native Americans. We have Tomahawk missiles, Black Hawk helicopters, Apache helicopters. But it would seem that these names are not an attempt to honor Native people, but do they instead perpetuate a negative stereotype, a warrior mentality that perhaps is not true?
Well, they do in many ways, but you know, perhaps the most interesting and most recent case is that of when Osama bin Laden was assassinated by the U.S. military. The operation was called Operation Geronimo, Enemy Killed in Action, EKIA, which was very much opposed by the Native community when, you know, people found out that, you know, someone who is revered in the Native community, Geronimo, is what they use in this last, you know, a couple of years ago as the name for Osama bin Laden as a code name in the military. It's not an honor. It's not an honor at all. You know, what I find to be kind of interesting is that in the military vernacular, like off the reservation means that you're leaving the base. You're going off the reservation into Indian territory. I mean, some of the vernacular still remains. So if commanders are still bringing up Indian war, you know, mythology in this day and age in a very, very powerful military, one would find that to be of some concern. And particularly, you know, what I will tell you, which is, I think if you read the book, you do know, is that Native people in the United States have the highest rate of enlistment in the military of any population. And we are overrepresented in the military, and we also have the highest rate of living veterans. And because of that, you know, the U.S. military's impact in Indian country is very significant, but also I feel like there's a measure of respect that is due to Native people, and that is not reflected when someone, you know, uses terminology that kind of remanufactures the Indian wars in this new millennium.
The publication of your book really is very timely. I don't know if you're following what's happening here in Michigan, but the state of Michigan recently has filed a complaint against the U.S. Department of Education's Civil Rights Office to put an end to the use of American Indian names, mascots, different types of imagery in our school districts. And the argument that the state makes is that using these names and images creates what they call an unequal learning environment that violates federal civil rights law. Have you found that to be true?
Oh, that's really interesting. I did not know the state of Michigan has done that. I applaud the state of Michigan for that action. A lot of studies have been done on the impact of mascots on Native students, and they're not positive. You know, it's not a positive set of imagery. There's this set of associations that kind of sticks Native people in a certain place and in a certain caricature. I mean, if people care about American history or present civics, you don't learn about Native people through calling them Redskins or calling them the Fighting Sioux out of North Dakota. We are a part of all classes that are at the university, and it is really important that we're not characterized and, you know, stuck in some place. So I'm really proud the state of Michigan has taken that.
One of the reasons I had wanted to talk with you, Winona, is that February 27th is the 40th anniversary of the start of the American Indian Movement occupation at Wounded Knee, South Dakota, which of course was very symbolic of the huge massacre there in 1890. Any thoughts on the coincidence of the publication of your book and the 40th anniversary, and also the fact that just about 4 months ago, the activist and actor Russell Means passed away?
Now, thank you for bringing that up. You know, in 1973, Lakota elders and families occupied the land at Wounded Knee on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota for 71 days to protest the corruption that had occurred.
The militant American Indian Movement called this meeting to seek the support of the tribal elders of the Pine Ridge Reservation for a bold plan to force federal attention to Indian demands. Not all of the hereditary chiefs attended, and among those who did, it was clear there was not total support for the militants.
They were faced with a huge arsenal of the U.S. military, huge numbers of armored personnel carriers, and a full-on slot that, you know, lasted for 71 days against, you know, people that were very few in numbers.
The Oglala Nation is at a crossroads that can change the course of history for Indian people all across the nation. And sometimes there has to be violence to force the white man to listen. You leaders, you chiefs, have to be right there with us when we do it. But we seize Wounded Knee. Either we force the federal government to kill us all once again like they did 83 years ago at Wounded Knee, or else they come out and they negotiate and meet our demands.
The Wounded Knee takeover took place, you know, at the location of the Wounded Knee Massacre of December 29th, 1890. And there the U.S. cavalry surrounded and slaughtered about 300 unarmed men, women, and children, Lakota people. And, you know, ironically, there were 43 Congressional Medals of Honor that were awarded to the soldiers who participated in that. You know, I find that problematic. And we're asking for a lot of those to be, you know, withdrawn at this point. But you shouldn't get Medals of Honor for killing Indians.
In your book, you mention Ira Hayes. He was a corporal in the Marine Corps in World War II, fought at Iwo Jima. In fact, he was one of the six men in that famous photograph of the flag raising on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima. Ira Hayes was a member of the Pima tribe in Arizona, and as the war was ending, he was taken out of combat and put into a war bond campaign that you could argue exploited him. He suffered from post-traumatic stress disorder and became an alcoholic, and he died at age 32, about 10 years after the war ended. It's interesting that when you look at the photograph, he is the one on the far left-hand side, the one who just can't quite reach the flagpole. He can almost touch the flag, but can't. Do you see a metaphor there?
I do. I hadn't really thought of it that way, but it's true. We're at the front lines in the military, and yet when we come home, things are not so good. And they went away, you know, hoping that they could get a little bit more for their families because they're coming out of dire poverty, many of these communities. And what they had hoped was when they came back, they would be in a better situation. And indeed, some are. There's no question about it. But a good portion of those who serve in the military and a good portion certainly of those who serve in the military in Indian country, at the time I wrote this, and to a certain extent now, came back and they were treated as second-class citizens indeed. And so it is an ironic story.
Winona LaDuc is a member of the Anishinaabe Nation and the author of The Militarization of Indian Country, which is now available through the Michigan State University Press. Ms. LaDuc, it's really been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for your time today.
Miigwech, thanks for calling.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.